Hi everyone, so welcome back to the second lecture for Tensor on Tensor Networks. So yeah, so I think I just want to start, like just do a brief recap of yesterday. So yesterday we were talking about many body wave functions. Many body wave functions, that was one part of it, and we were drawing these as, you know, introducing this diagrammatic notation for them. Another thing we were talking about were tensor network diagrams in general and how to count their contraction complexity, you know, things like that. Then we were talking about density matrices and reduced density matrices, and we'll come back to that actually today. The reduced version of it. And we were also talking about entanglement entropy. So von Neumann entanglement entropy. Entanglement entropy S for a given density matrix rho, which is minus the trace of rho log rho. Okay, that was a quick recap. So, and today what I want to talk a little bit about is how those things, you know, come together in the tensor network world. And what, you know, the goal of today's lecture is to talk a little bit about area laws of entanglement, what those are, why they are important. Then we'll talk a little bit about matrix decompositions. In particular, one very important one is the SVD. We'll spend some time on that because it's just very fundamental and comes up all the time. We'll talk about Schmidt decompositions and then how to use that to do wave function truncation. And then we'll hopefully like come into like the part where we talk about matrix product states and, you know, how, what they are, and give you some basic introduction to that. All right. Okay. So then let's go ahead and start. So the first thing I want to talk about today are, I want to start this discussion or this lecture off with area law of entanglement. So Roger already mentioned that yesterday a little bit. So the area law for entanglement is, so it has been found that certain types of quantum systems obey a so-called area law of entanglement. And that's, you know, what I want to quickly follow. I can describe here in the following. So what we're going to follow consider here is a system on a quantum lattice, or a quantum lattice system in d spatial dimensions. So we may have something like this. And this could be in d equal to 2. So you have two spatial dimensions, x and y. This is y, this is x. And these are, could, this is a lattice of spins, for example, where we have like spin degrees of freedom here and on all the other ones. And on that system we considered, so there for these systems, there should be a Hamiltonian. Did someone ask a question? No. There will be a Hamiltonian that has some, that runs over some, over so x here is something like denoting, is an index, well, maybe index, yeah, let me write it as I, it's always a, so the Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms where each of these hi here has some local support that is, you know, constrained into some region. For example, it could be, for if you look at spin Ising model, for example, it would be something like this. So then here this hi could be something like SIZ, SI plus 1Z, plus some magnetic field, for example, SXI, plus some H times SX on I plus 1, right? So we're talking about Hamiltonians that have local support. So they're connecting neighbors, for example, or maybe a little bit further, spins that are a little bit further away from each other, but not something that, you know, everybody is connected to everybody. So, you know, like spins only, like quantum systems only feel their immediate neighbors, or maybe their neighbors that are a little bit further away, but that is the setting we're considering. It's not super precise, but let's just leave it like that for the moment. And then we are looking, so we had, that's the setting, and then we are interested in the case where the system is in the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So that Hamiltonian has a, so we're looking at a Hamiltonian that has a unique ground state. So that's also a prerequisite. H has a unique ground state, and it could possibly be gapped, right? So this means that there is a, that Hamiltonian could have the lowest energy state, and the first energy, first excited state may have a finite energy difference that does not disappear as you make the system infinitely large. So that's what we call a gapped system. Now we will consider on that, on this lattice, we have a state rho. Let's actually call it AB for now. So I'll erase that again because I need to draw something a little bit more clearly. So we have a ground state on this system here, defined by a density matrix that is, and we assume it's in a pure state. So we have a state psi. So psi is the ground state of this Hamiltonian, and we're looking at these types of density matrix of this state. And what we're doing now is we will consider cutouts of this lattice. So what we'll do is we'll look into three different regimes in three different spatial dimensions. So one spatial dimension, two spatial dimension, and three spatial dimensions. And so what we'll study is how do we'll study this density matrix here, and what we'll in particular we'll study reduced versions of that density matrix, and then we'll make some conclusions or some statements about how these density, how these density matrices, how their entropy scales or how their entropy behaves as a size of the of some. As a function of some number that I'm going to introduce now. So let's look at one spatial dimension. So what we'll do is we'll take a system, and now we'll look at regions in the system of finite size L. So this is L, and this could be an infinite quantum lattice. You know, this goes to plus infinity, and this goes to minus infinity. So we have a lattice of of quantum spins, and we'll look, that is in the ground state of this Hamiltonian, and we'll look at a cutout here. We'll consider two cases. One is where that system has a gap, and one where the system is gapless. And I'll just write it down. So what we're going to do, so we'll consider here this density matrix on a system of size L, so rho L, which is the trace of rho, where we'll trace out all the sites that are not in this region L. Okay, we'll trace out everything else, and we'll end up with a density matrix here on that system. And what it turns out is that if you look at quantum systems at ground states of local Hamiltonians, then it turns out that these density matrices have the property that their entanglement entropy, or this the von Neumann entropy, behaves in a very peculiar way. Namely, if you're looking at a one-dimensional system, it is constant, right? This is what people call an area law. What this means, so area law, why? Because area law of entanglement entropy states that, what we mean by an area law is that the entropy of a certain region with a volume V scales only proportionally to the boundary of the volume, right? So this is what people call an area law. Area law for the entanglement entropy. And in d equal one is a very special case and we'll see later on that relates to various special properties of so tensor networks, in particular MPS, they are set up in such a way that they immediately obey that type of area law. So, but let's go back. So, what the statement here is that entanglement entropy of of this region is constant. So this means, and in you know hand wavingly, what this means is that there are this system here cannot be arbitrarily entangled with the rest of what's going around, the rest what's surrounding it. There is only some sort of a finite amount of entanglement that can build up. You know, there is some sort of a local interactions can induce local entanglement, and everything is very confined. So that's a very special property.
When you're defining rho sub L,
yeah,
your subscript, you're tracing over everything, all I's that should not be in L.
Yeah, that's right, sorry. That's everything that is not in L is traced out. So, and, all right. So let me reduce that. So one, so that is a very important statement. People have looked at that, so there has been, yes.
I was just wondering how strongly this depends on the system being infinite.
On this, the question is if how strongly the statement depends on the system being infinite?
Yeah.
So it doesn't actually depend on. So you could also, so the what you just want to have is that essentially the system around that is surrounding this thing here should just be larger than the system you're looking at here. So that is essentially what we're, that is the essential part of the argument, that you know whatever is not part of L should be larger than L, so that there it could in principle build up a lot of entanglement. But but it doesn't really depend on how large the system is. So the statement is, as you make L, you could also embed this into a large but finite system. And then you could look at the entanglement of this thing with the rest. As you make the system smaller and smaller, of course, then at some point you will reach a point where if there's nothing there, then there can be no entanglement, right? So if you make it only a little bit larger, can only be a little bit of entanglement. But the point is as you make this larger and larger and larger, the entanglement of this region with the rest saturates at some point. It doesn't grow to infinity or anything. It just like grows to a constant and stays there, and nothing else happens.
And that would be like related to the locality of the terms in the Hamiltonian.
Yes. So there is. So it is. There are. So I'm not going to like talk in any detail of it, also because I don't know all the intricate details. This is like a very rich field where people have spent their careers on trying to understand and study these this type of behavior in many different types of systems. But so the statement is that there is some relation to locality. It's like goes into like the definition. So the prerequisites are that the Hamiltonian is local. So it should not be, so these terms here, these HI cannot connect anybody to anybody. So everything has to be confined. So that is like one prerequisite, but it's very general. So this is one of the observations is that the entanglement entropy saturates, or for systems in one dimension, the entanglement entropy of a finite region, if the system is gapped, is constant. What you'll see is, so there is like two different cases one needs to usually consider. For gapped systems, everything is fine. So the entanglement entropy is constant. If the systems are gapless, so this is like systems that are critical, for example, this statement gets slightly modified. So what you'll get in this case is that the entanglement entropy of that region of size L grows logarithmically with L. It's a very weak growth, right? It's not strong. It's very, very weak. So that's the case for d equal to 1. And then, you know, the similar statements hold for larger dimensions, yes?
Can you clarify what gap and gapless are referred to?
Yes. So gapped means when I think, so quantum systems are, so they're quantized, right? So typically you have something like, if this is, you could have here the energy. Systems have some sort of a spectrum, right? So this is the spectrum of a quantum system. So if you have a many-body system with many spins, then the spectrum becomes extremely dense, right? There will be many, 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 many levels. Essentially, they can be, you know, they can be super dense. So people don't talk about levels anymore. They talk about densities at this point. But gapless, a gap system is a system where the ground state, the lowest energy, of the system. And the first excited state of the system, E1 here, you know, if this gap, so this is sometimes called delta, E1 minus E0, if this thing here is finite, this remains finite for any size of the system, right? Finite for all n, where n is the number of sites you have in a quantum system. So as you make the system larger and larger and larger and larger, there will always be a finite energy difference between the lowest state and the first excited state. This is what people call a gapped system. If that is not the case, so sometimes you'll see that some systems don't have that property. These are critical systems, systems that phase transitions, for example. What you'll see there is that there will be a lot of states with no energy difference there, right? So it's like a huge number of, or maybe sometimes many, sometimes less. So it doesn't have to be a lot, but there just is no gap. Okay, so yeah, I hope that clarified that. So then, so in the equal one dimension, what one observes is that for gap systems, the entanglement entropy is independent of the size of the system, and for gapless systems, it grows logarithmically with the size. And in larger dimensions, similar statements hold. I'm not going to like draw this in any detail. In two dimensions, you know, the situation is somewhat similar. So as you make the system regions of size L by L, and then what you'll observe is that for gapped systems, again, this density of rho L in this case grows proportional to L, right? Because the size, the area, so the volume in this case is L squared, and the boundary, so the area law says that a quantity that is defined on a volume, there is a volume and a quantity of that volume grows only with the boundary of the volume. So in this case, it grows only like L. And in three dimensions, you'll get something like L squared. And that has actually quite profound implications on which type of systems you can simulate or with which type of tensor network, for example. There are very, you know, intricate connections between these type of things. Now, for this is for gapped systems. For gapless systems, again, for as an example, so gapless systems are example free fermions. So there are some results out there that show that free fermions that have something like a 1D Fermi surface. So these are systems that have these are systems that have gapless excitations. So you can have a ground state, but then you have like many possibilities of exciting from that state at essentially no energy. In that case, this looks a little bit different. So you get, again, a logarithmic correction. So it's L log L in this case. Here it's, I think, L squared. Log, now I have to look, see, I think it's also log L, yes. Yeah. So you get some sort of a weak deviation from that behavior. Okay, so this is very, so why is this surprising? This is surprising because if you look at a quantum state, a random state that you would draw from, you know, all of Hilbert space, you would never see that behavior. So a random state has volume law entanglement. Which means that, is there any place where I can put this? No. So I'll move this up here. So random states, so random quantum states they have volume law entanglement. Which means that S of rho L, you know, grows proportional to the volume of L. The volume of a region of linear size L. So, and that is what you usually, if you just pick a random state, what you would observe. So, the ground states of local Hamiltonians are extremely special. they are very, very special. Like, they are essentially a set of measure zero in all of Hilbert space, right? So, but they are, turns out they're very important. Okay, so.
Are volume law states unsimulable, or they, I imagine they represent some sort of high computational cost to work with?
Yes, so it is, I think at this, so for tensor networks, they are. But then there may be, there's some, you know, it's not, I think it's not a priori clear that any volume law, so sometimes, like Roger yesterday said, for example, that in like Boltzmann machines, for example, can restrict them, can present volume law machines, restricted volume law states, restricted Boltzmann machines. But I think it is not clear. So simulating them might be hard, optimizing them might be hard. You might be able to do some sort of computation with it. I don't know all the details about that, but for tensor networks, for sure, there is. If something has a volume law, then it becomes very inefficient to do that with a tensor network. So tensor networks are really those apply well to systems that have, you know, this like ground state entanglement behavior that one observes or that we discussed here. Okay, so just a few. So an example of a state. This, I think, always very good. So here is an example of a volume law state for volume law in 1D. That's a very stupid state, but I'm still going to show it. It's called the rainbow state. So the rainbow state is a state where, so I'll actually need some sort of a definition. So I'll define, again, a singlet psi on two spins as all right, so I'll use this definition and I'll draw this as, you know, something like this. Well, let me actually do it like this. Yeah, so I'll draw it like this, right? A wave function. So where this is spin one and this is spin two, and you can also, you know, maybe draw it like that. And now we'll construct a state in one dimension from a number of those singlets, right? So we start here. All right, and then we go like that. Consider this is the center of the system. And now we put a singlet here, and then we'll put a singlet here, and then we'll put a singlet here, you know, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to draw all of them. If you look at that state, what we'll do now is, we'll look at this left half here and this right half, and we'll look at a cut across this line here. So we'll have, so this is our state here, and what we want to do is we want to compute the entanglement entropy of the left side with the right side. Okay, so the state is, the state psi that we're going to consider is a product over all these, over all these psi s's, let's psi s with some index I. And what we want to do is, what we're going to do, we have arranged them in some way, and we'll compute the density matrix on, let's say, L smaller, or let's call this left, on the left side, by tracing out all the L bigger than zero, so L smaller than zero of this state psi psi. Okay, and if you do that, so you compute this thing, and then you compute S of rho L, and what you'll see is the following behavior. Let's start with one, or we go from one to three. Let's start, if you look at one system, right, only one spin, what you'll see is you cut it through, then the entanglement that that you get from this case, you cut it through here, you'll see that this has an entanglement S of rho. Can you see that? Is that possible for you to see it? Or is it, so here is, so this is, let's say, a negative and this is positive, so S of this rho L, what did I call it? L smaller 0 will be 1. Or log, actually will be log 2, I think. Let me see. Yeah, it will be log 2, sorry. So it's log 2. And then we do, now we add another one. So if we cut this, now we have to cut two lines. Every time we cut a line, we will have to add 1 log 2 here. So this will become 2 log 2. And then, you know, if you go, if you have n of those, where this is n, so we're cutting n lines here. So then this will be n times, so rho s of rho, smaller, or where, you know, this L is smaller than 0 of this left half here, will be n times the log 2. So we'll see it grows linearly with the system. This is a volume law entanglement. But the Hamiltonian, so you could think that there is a Hamiltonian for this type of state for which this is the ground state, right? You could say that the Hamiltonian that could be such that, you know, it consists of sums of terms that connect states or, you know, spins that are increasingly far away. So here you could have a spin-spin coupling that wants the system to be in the singly ground state. This could be something like, so here you could have, I'm writing it down here. So this would be something like an S type of coupling with a probably a posi I and J, where this is side I and this is side J. So such a type of coupling would force, would, you know, would like the spins to be in the ground state, in, like would like the spins to be in a singlet. So there is a Hamiltonian to that, but this Hamiltonian is very non-local. Okay, so everything checks out so far. Very good. So that is all I wanted to say about area law entanglement. And, you know, I think it's important to be aware of that. But because, you know, we'll come back later to this property, or this property will play a role in understanding when you can use tensor networks to apply certain types of states, to approximate certain types of ground states. Okay. So the next thing I want to discuss are matrix decompositions. So matrix decompositions play an important role in tensor networks simulations, because that's, at the end of the day, what you do a lot. So there are certain types of matrix decompositions you do all the time. And I want to discuss like two special cases. One is called the singular value decomposition. Also called SV, abbreviated as SVD. And the other one is a QR decomposition, but I may actually skip that because it's not so important. So I'll just mention it here so that you guys are aware of it. But we may not need to. I think I'm not going to talk a lot about it. Okay, so what is the singular? So singular value decomposition is a matrix decomposition that takes in a matrix and decomposes it into a product of other matrices. All right, so we're given one matrix, M. This could be an n by n matrix, or an m by n, let's actually say it's an m by n matrix, m by n. And what we're doing is we're taking that matrix and decomposing it as a product of three other matrices. Has everyone seen that? Like, are people familiar with the SVD? Okay. I mean, I'll try to go quicker then. So these matrices have certain properties, right? So the matrix U is called a left isometry, and it has the property that I'm always forgetting. I think it's that U dagger U in this case is the identity. So U dagger U is the identity, but U U dagger is not the identity, right? V, people call a right isometry. And that has the property that V dagger V, sorry, V V dagger is the identity, but V dagger V is not the identity. And then S are singular values. Singular values with, you know, the SI, let's call it small SI, bigger or equal to zero. So these are values that are bigger or equal to zero. The SVD exists for any matrix. Every matrix, you can always write it, you know, do an SVD decomposition of that. And there is like lots of packages that do it for you. So we won't do it ourselves. So we'll use, you know, whatever package there is available to do that. We'll do that in the afternoon today. Diagrammatically, this is how this looks. You have a matrix M, and we will use this notation to denote an SVD, okay? Where this is U, this is V, and this is S. Okay, so now we have like triangles. These triangles tell us in which direction we can connect the indices such that they give us identities or they won't. Okay, so here is a very simple mnemonic. It looks like that. This is the identity. We can represent it with a straight line. And this is true for either U or V. Now, this is a little bit a shortcoming of this notation, right? You have to say, am I putting in here U or V? So this, in fact, is U dagger, right? So let's put a dagger here. And this is U. And the same is true for V. This is the other relation. Okay. And this is not equal to 1. This is not a straight line. So these objects here, like U, these things here, they are projectors to the left and right singular vectors, left and right singular vector space of this matrix M. So U and V, the columns and rows of these matrices are called left and right singular vectors. And they also form a vector space. Okay, so you can, so they are part of some vector space. So, and these matrices here project into like these spaces of left and right singular vectors. Okay, so usually the SVD is, unique up to some phases you can add, right? And that is also an important practical thing. What you can do, so you have a matrix here, you have a diagonal matrix here and another matrix here, U and V. This is a diagonal matrix. So what you can always do, you can insert another diagonal here with angles, e to the I phi 1. Let's call it, yeah. So these are complex phases that you can add here down to some phi n. And then you can undo that on the other side. You add a minus I phi 1 minus I phi n. And that makes it non-unique, right? So you can sort of, that decomposition, like what you can put angles on this diagonal and the complex conjugate of those on that diagonal, and it's the same result, but it's not unique in that sense, right? And if the values here, if there are some degeneracies in the singular vectors, right, you may have something like, okay, there might be some block where all of these here are identical. Then you can do more than just add a diagonal phase. You can rotate those guys within their subspace and nothing will happen, right? So then there will be a unitary degree of freedom where all these vectors that belong to these to this degenerate vector space can be rotated into each other. It's another degree of freedom you get. So why is the SVD so important? It is important because you can use it to compress matrices. Let's see. Are we going to do that? I'm kind of. This goes up here. Then the mid goes down. And this goes. a little bit further. Sorry about that, it's very confusing to handle. Okay, so then you have, we can do SVD compression of matrices. SVD compression. And what's happening there is we essentially can take a matrix M and we can find another matrix M tilde with a rank, with a ranks, you know, that matrix M has a rank R. And we can find, SVD allows us to find another matrix M tilde with a rank R tilde, smaller than R. That is the, in some sense, the optimal matrix for that, right? So the SVD matrix, if, and that's what I want to quickly show you. So if you take the matrix M and you decompose it as U, as V, so then you have some diagonal of singular values. And what you can do now is you can chop away a bunch of them, right? You can say, well, I don't want to use all of them. I just like chop away the smallest ones. So this, I didn't say that, sorry, actually, they are ordered usually. They have different sizes or different magnitudes, and you can order them from large to small, where the smallest ones can be zero if they want, like sometimes they are. And then you can approximate, you can do the SVD, then you can approximate that matrix by throwing away a part of that singular values. And that way, you'll arrive at some matrix S tilde that has like values thrown away, and then you get a matrix M tilde that is an approximation to M. And if you're using the Frobenius norm to measure distances between matrices, then that matrix is the optimal matrix. That is the one that has a, is like optimal in the sense of measuring the distance between M and M tilde within the Frobenius norm. So the Frobenius norm of a matrix is given as the square root of the trace of M dagger M. So if you use that, so and what and the statement is, this matrix M tilde minimizes the minimum over all M tilde, or of M minus M tilde, where this is the Frobenius norm, is given where M tilde has a rank R tilde smaller than R, you know, and this has a rank R, then this is obtained from the SVD, from truncating the SVD. Truncating SVD. All right, that's it. Did anybody know that? Or is it new to anyone? If not, then great. And if you already knew it, then okay, then we'll waste some time. But okay, so now we'll go into the next topic, is the so-called Schmidt decomposition, like using the SVD. So why were we using all of this? What I'm trying to do is build up towards how to use these tools to truncate wave functions. So because that's what we want to do at the end of the day.
Sorry, Martin, the online audience is saying, I think somehow on only some boards, just a little bit is getting cut off. If you could maybe move the link,
Like here.
Yeah, that's actually on this one? Yeah. Anyway, maybe that's even too much, but I think that's safe.
Okay.
Could you also make the last board visible?
Yep. Sorry about that. So this was the rear one. This one?
I think it actually was the stationary board.
Oh, I see. Maybe I'll just, you don't use that one. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So what we want to do? So why am I introducing that? Because the point is that we'll use the SVD and the related Schmidt decomposition to truncate wave functions. So we start with a wave. What we want to do is approximate ground states of Hamiltonians, and we know that some of them has a so-called area law, and this means that their entanglement is finite, and we'll use this fact. Or their entanglement is bounded, and we'll use that fact to, together with the SVD, and that's what I'll show, is that you can use the SVD to efficiently truncate these wave functions in an optimal sense. And that will bring us back, bring us essentially to what a matrix product set is, or what matrix product set does. So the Schmidt decomposition is a very simple decomposition that uses the that uses a singular value decomposition of a wave function psi ij, ij, where you have like 2 degrees of freedom. So this is a matrix, or you can view this again as this object here. And so this is a matrix where this is I and j. And the singular value decomposition is nothing else in essence. Sorry, the Schmidt decomposition is nothing else in essence than a singular value decomposition of this guy. So we'll write it as something like a u I m, right? Then we have some s m. And the sum here goes. So this is a sum over ij. And here we have a sum over I and j and m. Then there is some s m. Then we have a v mj. And then again our I and j. And then we'll write this, we'll just rearrange the sums and everything. So we'll end up with an m s m. A sum over j, u, sorry, let me write this as a sum over I, u I m I, and then a sum over j, v m j, j, oof, okay. And this we'll just write as a sum again over m, so here we have an s, and then here we have a state that I know, we can call it phi I, oh, sorry, phi m. And here we have a state that we can call, you know, phi and psi. No, psi is not good. Let's call it gamma. Well, that's really, there is a standard notation. People all use something like gamma, alpha and gamma, for example. That is one of the ways they usually write it. So this is what people call the Schmidt decomposition, right? So what we've done is we've taken this tensor and written it in this form. So yeah, here is this, and here is this, right? There's bending legs. Schmidt decomposition, very good. And again, what we can do now, so this is now a wave function. I was telling you before about truncation. What we can do, this is the matrix S, right? So we can approximate, we can truncate that wave function by throwing away the small singular values of this guy. And so then, you know, that way we would just have an approximation to our wave function. So what it turns out is that many wave functions, if you look at, you know, if you, let's say this could, for example, in our previous case, this could be all the degrees of freedom to the left of one cut. This could be all the degrees of freedom to the right of a cut. What turns out in practice is that if you look at ground states, for example, in one dimension, and you do this type of decomposition across some sort of cut, so you have an MPS, for you have a chain of quantum systems that is a 1D system where the Hamiltonian is sort of only connecting nearest neighbors. Let's say for now, and now we do a cut somewhere here, okay. So we have the system in a ground state, we cut it apart. Now if you look at that wave function, there will be a wave function associated with that where all these degrees of freedom are I, all these degrees of freedom are j. I just denote them that way. Now we can look at the Schmidt spectrum, or the spectrum of singular values that we would obtain from this. Well, what we would see very often, if we put here the index of the Schmidt, of the singular value, and here the singular value, what you will see is like it will decay very, very rapidly. Right? Very, very fast. It will just whoop, go down and become like super, super, super small. So what you can do is you can just throw away some part here. Right? You just say, well, I don't really care about all these very small singular values because there is throwing away these small singular values will in some sense make only, you know, make change, introduce very, very small changes. For example, if this would be 10 to the minus 7, right? Everything that's smaller than 10 to the minus 7, I'll throw it away. So that is what people call truncation. This is what people do when they truncate singular values. So when they truncate wave functions with MPS, that's the way, that's how they think about it, yes?
Is this the same as writing it as product states, or it's different?
It's not a product state. So product state would be a state where you have only one on the left and one, it's a sum of product states, if you want to say so, right? There is like M, this sum M here runs over one value. There is like capital D different singular values here. And what I didn't say is that for wave functions, the largest one, if the wave functions are normalized, will always be one, right? So the largest one you'll find will be one, and then it will go down. But there is many different here. So these are, there could be hundreds or thousands of those, but they decay very, very rapidly. In general, there will be as many as you have. So there will be exponential. The number of those that are non-zero in general are exponential with the with the number of degrees of freedom you have on the right-hand side, right? If you have n spins on the right-hand left-hand side, for example, you have 2 to the n. Of these non-zero singular values that cross, can cross the system or can cross, can induce correlations between those two systems. So, but this is what people would call when they, this is what people say when they truncate wave functions, that's what they do. You can also see sometimes if you look at, you know, a spectrum of Schmidt values that would just be constant, right? This would be another case where you have, you know, singular values and you, and the index of them. They're constant, there is nothing you can do, right? If you cut, you'll just make a huge error here. And sometimes you're lucky, you know, this is just, there is no guarantee when does one case happen, when does the other case happen. We know that for ground states, well, it looks like that is happening. There is like in 1D, you can, it's rigorous, and in higher dimensions, there are, due to this like our area law behavior, there is some theory that tells us, you know, that tells us how we expect these to behave in ground states, and because of that behavior, we can sort of, you know, do things by truncating. But if that's not going to happen, if this behavior is not there, then truncation is not very good or is not the right approach, and then also tensor networks usually don't work. Okay, is there any more question? Any more questions? Yes.
So the Schmidt decomposition is based on the SV,
yes,
the Mullen 2 norm.
It is a Frobenius norm usually, what people. So it's optimal in the Frobenius norm sense, yes.
Is there like any physical significance for your decomposition that's optimal in some other P norm?
I guess. I don't know. It's a good question. So this is something I'm not sure, actually. I don't think so. Usually, so because the way you'll see later, the way you will do this for wave functions, the Frobenius norm is the one that naturally arises there. But I mean, you can, in principle, you could minimize it still. You could have, what you could do is you could take, you could try another approach by, for example, doing some sort of minimization over another, where you try to minimize another norm instead of the Frobenius norm. I'm actually not sure how the SVD would play into that. Okay. So now I'll just just to reiterate that very quickly. So now we'll. So we'll just draw this out one more time, because I think it's very important. So what we'll do now is we'll go through this in a little bit more detail. Consider the following case, where you have a wave function that has this form. So this is a system. A wave function, for example, of spin 1/2 degrees of freedom, where we call these degrees of freedom region A and these degrees of freedom region B, right? We reshape that into a matrix. So we'll write this as so this line should just denote the separation, right? So we'll reshape this into a single index by, you know, combining it. So that's a very simple operation. Then we do an SVD of that. So we'll end up with this object. Oops, sorry. We'll end up with this object. And we can now, what we can now do is we can, so what I want, so where we want to arrive at is a connection between the singular values that we have, that we're seeing here, and the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, which are actually, so the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix are the thing that goes into the entanglement entropy, right? So you remember entanglement entropy depends on the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So what we want to do is we compute the reduced density matrix, for example, of this half, graphically without doing any actual computation. And then we'll see that the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix of this half here will in fact be the squares of the Schmidt values of this Schmidt decomposition. And that's a very, you know, that's something that also appears all the time. But that's an important fact. So you can write it like this. So this is just the Schmidt decomposition, if you want to say so. And now we compute the reduced density, so the density matrix of this thing. So we have psi psi, right, where this is psi. We'll write this as this object. So there is again a cut here, and then we have this. And then we can reformulate that using this object there. We'll end up with this. And here we'll have this, the complex conjugate. Okay. So now what we want to do is we want to trace out half of it, right? So we'll go here and we'll do the trace over, let's say, region B. Okay, so the trace over region B is nothing else than connecting all these legs. We'll do the same here. We'll do it all. I don't know, I think I missed some. Looks like a mess. So then what we'll use now is the fact that this is an isometry, right? Which means that if you do this, so formally, what I'm doing here corresponds to this, right? That's the operation I'm doing here. And we know that this is just a straight line because we have shown that before. So then we can just write this down as this. Like this, right? Is everyone on board with that? Okay. So what we have here is S, and another S, and it's real, so we don't really have to worry about the complex conjugate. So we'll get this here. We just write it like this. So this is S squared. This is V or V dagger, and this is V or V dagger. I'm not sure. It should be like this, but let's not worry too much about that. So this now is a unitary. Let's assume, this is a unitary matrix. If we keep all the Schmidt values here, complex conjugate of that. What we have achieved is we have written this with diagonalized row, right? There you go. So this is nothing else than V. Just write it out again, S squared V dagger. And this is essentially the spectral representation of the reduced density matrix of rho B, right? So this was rho A. So what we see is that the square of the Schmidt values are the reduced density, are the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So what happens now if we truncate? Well, if we truncation of the wave function, you know, I was telling you before, it means you throw away some Schmidt values. What that means is that, in effect, you're looking at the, you know, reduced density matrix. You're throwing away, like, eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So again, your reduced density matrix might have eigenvalues, let's call them P, that behave something like this. And you're throwing away a part of that, okay? And what you can, from this type of argument, you can now deduce that if the spectrum of that density matrix behaves in a certain type of way, then throwing away, same argument as before with the Schmidt values, if you throw something away here, you'll make an error, but the error will be very small if the Schmidt values that you're throwing away will be small. You can actually find an upper bound for that. I'm not going to derive it, but I'll just like play, let you, you know, I'll write it down. In fact, what you can show is that if that wave function psi is psi, then in the truncated version was psi tilde, right? So then, so this is, let's see, if this, you know, we were essentially cutting this, and then we were doing some SVD, and now what I'm telling you is that the psi tilde is again the wave function where I throw away a part here, right? Psi tilde is the one, is like a wave function where I throw away some singular values. Then the difference, so the norm difference between those two, will be the square root of the sum of the squares of the singular values that I throw away, where m are thrown out. So m is like indexing the values, the singular values that I threw away. And so this is a bound on the error that you're making. So then this is what people sometimes call the truncated weight, right? So this is the truncated weight that pops up in many types of different MPS simulations. So this is what people, when they do, for example, an MPS simulation, they tell you, you know, this is my truncated weight. They give you a value. And that is essentially some sort of an upper bound on, you know, what they have thrown, like their accuracy on the wave function. It tells them how confident they are about their result. Okay. And so one like technical term is when people talk about optimal truncation, that's what they mean by that. They talk about we're doing optimal truncation is truncation using the SVD, where you look at a wave function to exactly this type of truncation. Okay, so is it okay if we go a little bit longer? So probably like 10 minutes more? Okay. Where is the... Here. So I won't use the rear one, the last one. I'll just use the... Which one is the next? The top one?
I think the middle one.
Middle one, okay. So then this goes down. Wait, did I already? Ah, I see. I was already using, this was already the last one. Okay.
No, I think if you put rear up. No.
Okay, ah, yeah, there you go. Okay. So what we'll do now is we'll use this type of like argument to construct an MPS from a wave function. So what we'll do is we had our wave function here. That was this guy. Like five legs. And so what we'll do now is we'll just use iterated singular value decompositions to write this in a very special form. So what we'll do is we'll collect these two together. Let's actually only do three because it will be quicker. So we'll use these three here and this single index and do an SVD of that. So we'll collect them into one and do an SVD. So we'll end up with something like this. All right, so then three legs coming out here. I'll multiply this thing in. So this is nothing else than some matrix again. So if I combine those two into a single matrix, then it loses the orthogonality property. And then you just have this thing here. So now what we'll then we'll just iterate that procedure, right? So now we have that state. So what we'll do now is we'll take this object here, just this here, and repeat the procedure in the following way. Let me draw it here. So we'll have this thing and this. So we'll bend the first leg here to the right and have like two left here. And then we'll do an SVD according that, you know, we'll separate those two, we'll combine those indices together and do an SVD of that. So that will give us a matrix that looks like that. And we'll one leg, sorry, there was like two legs here, then one leg here, and then another two legs coming out here, right? And I can bend it just to make sure that the top, and it looks similar. And then we'll just insert that over here, right? So we'll have this object, and we go here. So what you have to do is, like, this line here corresponds to this one. This one corresponds to this one. So we'll write this as this. Okay, and then we have, again, this we combine into a general tensor again that doesn't have any orthogonality property. Now we have only two legs left. And then we can repeat the same procedure now with this guy. We just do the same thing again, and we'll end up with this thing. And then, you know, there will be something like this on that side. And that's what people call a matrix product state, okay? So what we have arrived at is a decomposition of a wave function into an iterate, into a, you know, into a factorization into, of, so this is a factorization of this wave function into a product of tensors, okay? Sometimes, so this is a little bit, maybe not, you may not be used to that way of writing it, because it uses these triangles here. So people would usually draw this this way. But this way of drawing it is a little bit more succinct, or actually more accurate, because it includes information about the properties of these tensors, which in this case means that they are isometric. They have some sort of orthogonality property. And that, OK, this is our first MPS. And this is, if you want to write it out, right, it looks something like this. Okay, so this is nothing else than a diagrammatic representation of this equation here, where each of these guys, A, I, n, alpha n minus 1, well, let's call it k, alpha k minus 1, alpha k, is this object, where this is the index alpha k minus 1, this is alpha k, and this is ik. Okay? Very good. So in general, these tensors, so this is a decomposition of this wave function into an MPS. Now what we did here was a bunch of SVDs, right? And I was assuming we were never throwing away anything here, right? We were just keeping all the singular values that we got. And if you do that, then the bond dimension of this thing here grows as you keep going from the left, or let me put it like this, from the left to the right. It will become larger and larger, right? So people call the bond dimension is this, the dimension of this bond here, or of these, all of these, the dimension of all these bonds is what people call the bond dimension. And this dimension, so the dimension of this bond, of this bond, of this bond, and as you keep on going many more, it will just grow exponentially, in fact. With the number of sites that you're applying this operation to, because we didn't throw anything out here, right? We didn't throw anything away. So now the point is that you can actually throw things away in certain cases, and if you do that, this essentially means, or what people do in practice is they say, well, you know, I can't afford a very large bond dimension, I'll just cap it at some point. That's one way of doing it. You say, well, the only largest one I want to use is 100. So I'll keep my bond dimension D smaller or equal to 100. And that's and what you're doing there is implicitly some sort of truncation. Okay, that's one way of doing it. That's what people may do in practice. If you do that, if you decide to make such an ansatz for your wave function, then it turns out that the number of parameters you need to represent a wave function is no more exponential, okay? Because if you say all my bond dimensions have to be smaller or equal to some maximum value, let's say 100, then as you keep adding more sites and more tensors, anytime you add a tensor, what you will add is d squared by 2, where this 2 here is So we know we were talking about spins, that is the dimension of this index here. You will add d squared by two numbers, right? So in print, so the total number of parameters that you have is just the number of spins times d squared times two. And that is polynomial in n. It's actually linear in n, right? And you can even bring that down to, you can get rid of that n in certain cases entirely, for example, if you use certain types of symmetries. Okay, so this is the number of parameters. The number of parameters of an MPS is polynomial. Polynomial in the system size. Okay. Very good. As you make that bond dimension larger and larger, you can explore larger and larger portions of your Hilbert space, if you want to say so. Okay, so one last thing I wanted to mention here, let's actually look at that, is in view of the tutorial in this afternoon, I think it might be good to discuss one last topic. We'll take probably 5 minutes, and then we can go and take a break. So I'll go up with this. I'll go down with this. Okay, so the thing I wanted to discuss is two things. Namely, one is essentially computation, how you do computations. Computations with MPS, because that's what we're going to do this afternoon. And as a simple example, I want to use expectation values to show you that you can do calculations with MPS that are, of very large systems very easily. And for that, we're going to look at a very simple calculation, which is the calculation of an expectation value. So the problem is the following. You're given an MPS psi on a spin 1/2 system, on n spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. Spin 1/2, and you want to measure an observable, let's say SZ, at some side n in the bulk of the system, right? So you have 5, 6, and let's say this could be many more. So you have an MPS here. And what you want to measure is an observable SC, right? And so this means you want to do this, psi SCI psi. Right, so this is the quantity you want to calculate. So let's say I is at site, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's say it's at site 3. Okay, so what you have here is an SZ at site 3. So what I'm doing here is I'm representing SC as a matrix already, because it's a matrix, it's a linear operator. And what you want to do is you want to calculate the overlap of this object with the state again, right? Where this is now psi, the conjugate, and this is psi, okay? So this is nothing else. This is just a graphical representation of this thing here. So how are you going to do that? The answer is, there's no unique answer. There's many ways of doing that, but there is one good way of doing it, and that is essentially by contracting that network, one tensor after the other, starting from one side and from left and from the right. And just we'll now erase pieces and bits of this diagram. What you'll start is you can start by contracting this thing here into a single tensor, and it will look like this. Okay. And that can be done efficiently. It's just a very simple matrix multiplication. The next step is you'll do the same. You take this and multiply it. Sorry, actually. You take this object and multiply this with this, right? So this will leave you with such an object. And now you multiply this thing with this here, which will leave you such an object. And then you're here, and you do the same from the right-hand side, right? So you go like this, then you go this, then you go this, and then you go this, and then you go this with this. You know, I know it looks a little bit messy here, but it's just the way it is. So then you end up with this thing, and now you repeat the procedure by going with this thing. So you'll have such an object, then you absorb this guy, and so on and so forth, right? So at the end of the day, if you absorb all of those again, you'll have this thing here. You have like two matrices. And this has formally is the same as computing the trace of a matrix A with a matrix B, OK? So that's how you this is how you essentially do some these types of calculations. OK, all right, I'll stop here. And in the afternoon, we'll have, a tutorial where we'll like implement a few of these types of calculations. I'll be here, and we'll may have some sort of a Blackboard discussion as well, just to help you along with the tutorial. So if you have more questions, let me know. If not, then we'll stop here.